cigarettes and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true will always love you no matter what you do.
Wow, it's the light, the light, the light,
the light, the light.
It's the light, the light, the light. It's the light, the light, the light.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices. Welcome to Spitfire Women of Color Radio every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. Tonight we are pleased to bring you an exclusive discussion with Nydia Dauphé and Professor Charmaine Nelson. Welcome in studio, Nydia.
Thank you for having me.
Nydia is a food justice advocate. Born to parents of Haitian heritage, she was born and raised in Montreal. She blogs about Canadian and international social and political affairs related to the right to food, food sovereignty, and sustainable development. And her work has sparked a major discussion about race, racism, and representation in Montreal and Quebec. Professor Charmaine Nelson is an associate professor of art history here at McGill University, who has made groundbreaking contributions to the field of visual culture of slavery, race and representation, and Black Canadian studies. Next, switching gears a bit towards the end of the show, we play an excerpt from Jackie Wang's keynote address at the conference, Engendering Resistance, Exploring the Possibilities of Gender Resistance and Militancy, at the University of Waterloo, held in April of this year. Revolutionary loneliness refers to the seemingly inevitability, traumatizing and alienating effects of participating in revolutionary struggle, and to the sense of loneliness that the experience of gendered and racialized forms of suffering can produce. Historically, revolutionary movements have based their politics on masculine and white positions and failed to eradicate social alienation. Jackie explores the liberation narratives of militant women and gender-variant revolutionaries. All this and more coming up on another edition of Spitfire Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. It is now just about 6:10. Over the past few months, we on this show have discussed the extreme reactions to open discussions of racism in Quebec. As a woman of color collective, our perspectives have been greatly influenced by the writing and courage of Nydia Dauphin. Her May 5th blog post on Huffington Post Canada, entitled "Why the Hell Are Quebec Comedians Wearing Blackface?" pointed out the resurgence of blackface donned by white Quebec comedians and offered a number of recent images demonstrating this trend. Her lucid commentary offered a moment to pause on the historical roots of blackface, the transatlantic slave trade that brought millions of enslaved Africans to the Americas for more than three centuries. Blackface minstrelsy was a popular, nostalgic site through which whites lamented the end of slavery, using dark, quote, humor, delivered in song, dance, and jokes that celebrated white fantasies of violence against black bodies. It is a disturbing reminder of slavery's evils and a symbol of anti-black racism. As Professor Nelson pointed out, the McCord Museum holds broadsheets, photography, advertisements, and other paraphernalia of Canadian minstrel troupes that performed in Canada in blackface in the 19th and 20th centuries. Nydia's plain and simple assertion that ugly forms of racism persist in Quebec society was mocked in many media outlets, as was Professor Nelson's response to the hostile reaction in the Montreal press. As a woman of color collective that comes together every month to say no to the silencing of the voices of women of color, to promote a platform for women of color to have self-determination, we are continuing the discussion today, and we are so thrilled to welcome Nydia to be with us in studio right here, right now.
Woo! Woo! Welcome, Nydia.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start this off by telling us a little about yourself and your work.
Well, yeah, I was born and raised in Montreal. As I was previously mentioned, I am of Haitian origins, and contrary to what came out, I am really from Montreal. I did all my studies here from high school, Collège Notre-Dame, Cégep Brébeuf. I did my undergrad here at McGill and then did a master's at Université de Montréal. So I am I'm a Montrealer. So right now I work for an organization that advocates for a national food policy for all and for the right to food, the human right to food. And what drew me to this is really food justice. And food justice, in a simple way, it's looking at the food system through a critical race theory lens. And that's my passion.
Wonderful. So let's just jump into the nitty-gritty of why we are all here today. So, among the countless discussions and critiques about the growing use of blackface within Quebec entertainment, why do you think that it continues to be used despite its racist history?
I think that it shows us that there's still a lot of work to be done in Quebec when we're talking about race relations. The history is there. I mean, just to look at the reaction that I received from my article, and I had people telling us that, you know, there was no slavery in Quebec, that blackface did not originate in Quebec, therefore it was pretty much devoid of its racist baggage. I mean, it's just baffling to hear that in, 2013, and from educated people are not too familiar with these issues. So I think it's just a reminder that there's still a lot of work to be done. Of course, there's a good quality of life here in Montreal, but we still need to understand that we have a long way to go to make sure that everybody is respected, regardless of skin color, gender, sexual orientation, and such. It's just a reminder, I think.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, had a white Quebecois woman written a response like this, like what you had written, do you think that it would have received the same reaction from Quebec society?
I think there are a lot of things that went into play regarding the backlash that I received. And I think to answer that question, we need to realize that not a lot of people want to talk about race relations in Quebec. It's very uncomfortable and it's exhausting. And also we have to take into consideration the reality of Quebec society. We have a majority that is white, francophone, identify as Quebecer, that have suffered from oppression from white Anglophone Canadians. And that is pretty much, that fact is pretty much tied in into their identity. So what happens is that there is not a lot of space allotted to people that are not, that do not identify to this group and that suffer oppression from this group to express and to state the oppression that they're victim of. And so I think that you know, that deters a lot of people from actually speaking out against racism. You see, like, victimization, or you become labeled as a victimologist, as bell hooks would say, both from people of color and non-people of color. And there's a shaming that happens where the person that is victim of the oppression or of racism is starting to be blamed. Like, mm-hmm. that, like, definitely happened to me in this event where I was called a racist, and I was going, bashing Quebec. And so I think when you put all these things in consideration and you still want to speak up, there are two ways that you can go about it, at least in my opinion. You could go, you know, the non-threatening way, holding people by the hand, this is what is going on, trying not to offend any people and not disturb the power dynamics, or go the way I went about it, which was pretty matter-of-factly, like, this is wrong, this needs to stop. And you look at this, the way that I looked at the issue or decided to address it, and add to that the fact that I'm a woman of color that chose to express herself in English. I mean, mm-hmm. in my opinion, that's just a lethal combination. So I think all these things have to be taken in consideration when we're talking about the backlash that I received. I definitely ruffled some feathers, and I didn't go the non-too-disturbing way, and that didn't sit too well with people. I think I disturbed perhaps the power dynamics.
Mm-hmm. So would you like to weigh in on that question?
I actually have a follow-up question. I'm wondering, in the reactions that you received that were particularly vitriolic, if you found that there was a specific pattern or a clear thread with which people would rationalize what you were essentially trying to claim, which was that this is a trend. There is a resurgence of this and it's a pattern. Yeah. What was the most common way people either rationalized that? Was it just pretending like that wasn't true? Just outright denial? Was it, I know you are, but what am I? Kind of like turning it around?
Yeah, there are a lot of threads. I mean, one of the common ones was that I'm an outsider. That's why I stated where I went to school in the beginning, because somehow I became somebody from Toronto that had no idea what was going on in Quebec. I didn't know anything about the Quebec culture, where mm-hmm. Quebec is all that I know. I was born and raised here. And another thread, as I mentioned, is, yeah, this does not affect us at all. This is an American issue. We were trying to flatter the guy. I mean, and then also the comedian that was impersonated, you know, quote unquote, also came out saying that, no, you know, this is just this obsession by some people to trying to make white people feel guilty. So there was complete denial and just a twisting of reality that was just surreal, that there was no real desire to talk about this issue. It was totally defensive and not trying to engage in honest discussions about race relations in Quebec.
So do you think it's more of an ignorant thing, more so than not trying to acknowledge it and just brush over it?
Yeah, I think it's a bunch of things. Ignorance takes you, to a certain distance. I mean, after that, you have to want to know. But, you can say somebody didn't know, but if the person does not want to know, then what is it? So I think that's what I was faced with a lot dealing with the situation, the reluctance to really hear what I was saying. Just the fact that the main arguments that were coming into these articles that were coming out, like La Presse, Le Devoir, Journal Le Métro, they were not addressing the other points that I raised in the first article, which was, racial profiling, the fact that our history is, it's really the history that is told by the, the conquerors, where we only like appear on slavery, and our presence here, if you think about the Costa, that was the one that pretty much was the intermediary between the indigenous peoples here for the European colonizers. I mean, that obviously shows us that our history is very rich, but that's not what we're taught. And so the fact that none of these points were addressed shows that, there wasn't a real willingness to address race relations in Quebec.
Well, thank you.
Are you discouraged at all by the reaction? Does it make you want to write less or be a little bit more cautious about what you write? Because we talk a lot on the show about how the wounds that women of color inflict when they speak their mind from a perspective that isn't usually represented in the outlets that you're describing necessarily, because of a lot of complicated reasons, lack of diversity, reluctance to include perspectives that could potentially be alienating to white Quebecers of a certain perspective. Do you feel discouraged in any way going forward?
No, actually, it still is an amazing experience to get to talk about these issues freely. I mean, this society is the only one that I know And if I cannot be myself and express myself and express racism, then it's not really worth living here. You know, this is home and we need to take that space. I mean, our parents, I'm sure your parents too, if you're born and raised here, help create Quebec, you know, help build this society. So how dare people make you feel that you don't, this is not your home. So, and also the support that I had from people, you know, across Quebec and across Canada, it really reinforced, you know, my feeling that this was the right thing to do, to react, and that there are other people that maybe because of, you know, the articles that I wrote, will feel compelled to also voice their experiences when it comes to racism in Quebec.
Amazing.
And we're very glad you decided to come out and speak out about this, because I think it's a very important issue, considering that it's something that seems to be a reoccurring problem here in Quebec. And the fact that we refuse to acknowledge it is problematic in its own way. But I think
it's really
this is
intense.
Opening doors.
It's really intense. Just the idea that naming a historically rooted racist practice is somehow associated or conflated with bashing the province of Quebec. That was really shocking.
That's a classic.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Professor Charmaine Nelson. You're listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Welcome back to Spitfire Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is now 6:23. We've been talking to Nydia Dauphin on the reactions to her blog post on the Huffington Post Canada earlier in the summer about the resurgence of blackface among performers in Quebec. We'd like to now welcome Professor Charmaine Nelson to the discussion. Professor Nelson penned a May 28th piece in the Huffington Post in response to the reactions to Nydia's initial blog post entitled "Challenging Blackface is Not Quebec Bashing. How daring." In it, she writes, quote, "Recalling our colonial histories and challenging the disturbing reemergence of blackface is not Quebec bashing. Is that where we are in 2013? Does being a true Québécois imply complicity in the silence surrounding Quebec's colonial histories and contemporary forms of practices of racism?" Those are posed as questions. The article is still online, and I would recommend it to any Canadian, anyone living in Canada. Professor Nelson, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you.
Hi, we welcome you to the studio via the phone.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I'd like to start by asking you to just talk about your reaction to Nydia's initial piece when you saw it, and then the reaction to the piece, and then what led you to add your voice to the debate that you saw.
Okay, great. Well, I'll start by saying that, you know, for people listening, I teach art history, but the way I come at art history is that I specialize in race and representation. The representations that came out of transatlantic slavery, and I look a lot at the way that black subjects have been represented in historical Western art. So in that vein, I have taught on the subject of blackface minstrelsy in courses I teach on the representation of black subjects in popular culture. So I was very aware at how heinous a practice it was and why it has been banned in, for the most part in places like the United States of America, right? We don't see those films anymore. They basically don't show them on channels like Turner Classic Movies anymore, right?
Right.
So coming forward then, I've been at McGill since 2003, and the big incident that jarred me was the ATC, Frosh Week, UDM 2011 incident with the students during Frosh Week again, who donned the Jamaican national colors and carried stuffed monkeys and appropriated and, you know, bastardized Jamaican patois in their performance of blackface minstrelsy. Yes, it was. They did it all. Those students did it all. They covered everything. So at that moment in 2011, I responded with a Montreal Gazette op-ed. Okay, and that was 2011. So coming forward then, you know, it was on my radar that I was seeing a pattern of resurgence of blackface, not just in Canada, but in the States. So then the thing that had happened, though, actually, if we go a bit earlier, is in 2010 we had the incidents at the Legion Hall during a Halloween party in Campbellford, Ontario, if you recall.
Right.
Okay, so that one, too, also was on my radar. Then the Haute Etude Commerciale incident at University of Montreal in 2011. And then we had the incident in 2012 at the McGill Halloween party.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had Mario Jean, of course, at the Gala de Olivier, which is the comedy gala in 2013. So we've had a string of these incidents happening in Quebec and in other parts of the country. So when Nydia wrote her piece, of course, it was already on my radar, but was really... I shouldn't say that I was totally surprised, because a lot of, and not all, but a lot of Euro-Canadians seem to have problems in dealing with or entering discussions on the state of contemporary Canadian racism and understanding that it comes from someplace, it comes from a suppressed history of racism in the nation, right? Mm-hmm. But the pushback on this one was so specific to an kind of specific articulation of who a true Quebecois is, and how a true Quebecois should behave, that it kind of showed a specific underbelly of a type of racism that's specific to this province. So that, to me, was an interesting and disturbing development in terms of the backlash that Nydia faced.
I also noticed in just rereading the comments on both your HuffPost blog and Nydia's earlier two pieces, there was this way in which the fact that even the words uttered were uttered in English, it was somehow allowed this whole window of opportunity to open up where people could dismiss your pieces as being somehow from an outside voice without even acknowledging the merit of the points, and somehow they seem to imply that only if the pieces had been written in French, or if the pieces had been written in French, somehow the discussion would have gone a completely different way. I'd like to get both of Professor Nelson's and Nydia's responses to that. Professor Nelson, if you'd like to go first.
Well, I think part of that, too, is, you know, okay, I just took a trip to Halifax for a week. And whenever I leave the province, it's like my shoulders relax. Like the knots, seriously, it's unbelievable. I mean, whenever I go anywhere, I go to the Dominican Republic, go to Jamaica, I go to the States, and it's like, why aren't I feeling stress? Like, why am I not feeling stress? And part of it is that in Quebec, you're called incessantly to name yourself on multiple levels always, right? Mm-hmm. Who are you? How well can you speak French? If you can't speak French fluently, why is that? Where do you come from? What color are you? It's an incessant barrage of self-identification that functions in a way that's actually more extreme than other provinces of Canada, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not terribly surprised by this idea that an English-speaking voice cannot be authentically Quebecois, right?
Mm-hmm.
That somehow I don't belong and I don't deserve a voice because I dare to write in English, right? Because that's another form of minoritization of a population in Quebec, right? The English-speaking minority, right? That gets kind of shunted off to the side as not having a true say in matters because we are not Quebecois, right? So that's kind of how I view that in terms of feeding into the broader problem of this idea of the pure lang or the pure wool Quebecois that runs very deep in the province.
And it doesn't seem, in Nydia, in your case, to be so much about language, because as you stated, you've born and raised here, you've schooled in French and English here, you're fluent in both. Your language skills shouldn't have seemed to have factored into it at all. You just happen to have written this in English.
Well, I was written off, though. I mean, even though my name is Nydia Dauphin, I mean, there's like a hint that I'm a Francophone, but it didn't matter. The fact that I chose to speak, to express myself in English, I think it was enough for some people to see, to box me as an outsider.
But I think, could I mention that too? Nydia raises a really interesting point about her last name, right? And, you know, part of the ignorance of colonization in Canada amongst, you know, a lot of people, but especially amongst your Canadians, is they forget that their forefathers forcibly changed the names of African people who they enslaved, right?
Exactly.
So my name is Charmaine Nelson for a reason, right?
Exactly.
My parents were born in Jamaica, and my ancestors at some point had their names, their African names, stripped, right? So a part of this, too, is that Nydia's Frenchness, which is a byproduct of her forced colonization of her ancestors, is also being denied, right? So mm-hmm. you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
And this is a real problem. There's a recent case with a black, I think, man of Haitian ancestry who was mm-hmm. driving his beautiful BMW, right? I'm sorry, his name is escaping me.
I think it's Bellefleur or something.
Bellefleur, something like that, right? It's a very French name, okay, last name. And the white officers basically saw him in a nice car. We're suspicious because a black man was driving a nice car, I take it. And they ran his license plate, and when they saw his name, they pulled it over because they assumed that a black man cannot have that French name.
Right.
So it's like this utter ignorance and denial of this history that it's like, hello, it's your ancestors who imposed the renaming upon Africans that led to this gentleman's name being so French. If you see what I'm saying, right? So part of it, too, is just like we're dealing with, and I don't mean ignorance in terms of stupidity. I mean a literal lack of knowledge,
right?
We're failing each other in this nation in terms of educating each other about the colonial histories of this nation.
Well, and that's how you open your article, right? You say you just finished teaching a class, and a majority of, I think it was all of the students who were Euro-Canadian students, or a majority of them were Euro-Canadian students, were not even aware of the fact that the transatlantic slave trade was practiced in Canada.
Absolutely. And I'm telling you, like, I mean, okay, I haven't been doing this that long, but I'm about a third of the way through my career. I've been working, teaching for 10 years.
I mean,
right?
That's pretty long.
That's pretty long. Yeah. I want to retire pretty soon, right?
I remember you when I was an undergrad, and I'm not even that old, so.
Exactly. So it's like for 10 years, I've been asking the same question of my students, and I still haven't gotten to a class that says, oh, I know, oh, I was taught in grade 2, or I was taught in, you know, grade 12 or something. I still have not gone to that. And maybe I'll retire before I see a class of Euro-Canadians show up who say, oh, that's old news. We were taught about Canadian slavery in high school, right?
Right.
But it says something that, because really, at McGill, there's not that many classes of the nature that I'm teaching mm-hmm. that opens up black diaspora issues in the Canadian context to students.
Well, I mean, at most universities, right? I mean, how many Black Canadian Studies programs, let alone departments and institutes, are there in the country?
Right, exactly. There actually aren't departments. There's not one department with its own dedicated faculty in the nation. There's nowhere in the nation that you can get even a minor, much more a major in honors in Black Canadian Studies. So we need to think about that, too, because in the States, there's hundreds of places where you can graduate with a degree in African American Studies. There's quite a few that have MA programs, and there's 7 PhDs,
mm-hmm.
right? And we're talking about two nations side by side that have very similar colonial histories. So mm-hmm. we have to ask why Canada has refused to allow African-Canadian issues to be institutionalized in Canadian universities and colleges, right?
Right. I mean, we've been talking about the particular perniciousness with which these kinds of discussions are met within Quebec, because in Quebec there's also this dynamic where this defensive posturing against an Anglo-Canadian I guess oppressor that gets clouds out even the limited space we have in the rest of English Canada to talk about these issues. I guess I'd like to ask both of you, Professor Nelson and Nydia, if you think that the work of public education or somehow getting a sea change and people really at a mass level understanding this history, do you think that it's just the case that we just really do have that much work to do in terms of educating, or what do you think it is? Because I suspect, I'm a little bit more cynical, and I suspect that this is a bit of, you know, out of sight, out of mind. I don't have to talk about it because it hasn't been institutionalized. So therefore, I'm allowed to forget it. And no matter how many times we talk about it and we remind people of the history and we point them to the references, as you both do in your articles, and, you know, what are your, I'd like to get your thoughts on that. Professor Nelson.
Do you want me to go first? Okay, so I think you're right. A part of it is that we have failed the nation in terms of education, and I mean that in terms of curriculum at every level that you can imagine, right? So what are we teaching the students in elementary schools? What are we teaching them at the high school level? And what can they possibly learn when they come through a university or college system, right? And, you know, elementary schools are pretty bad, too, in that the Black Canadian content that students will receive today, as in the day of my generation in Canada at the elementary school level, would be about the Underground Railroad. So it's a narrative of hooray for us Canadians, we freed the African American slaves, period.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It doesn't talk about that as only a 30-year window before which we were also slaving. So, you know, it's really, you know, it's not just that we are omitting the slave history and the history of the colonization and oppression of First Nations and people of color like Black populations in Canada. We are actually actively at the same time celebrating ourselves as liberators of African-American slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's a really biased, problematic history that we're actually being fed. And so the corrective has to come at all different levels of education, because quite frankly, there's not enough people like me to catch people at the age of 21 going through places like McGill.
Exactly.
Right? So we actually have a population that's very ignorant of Canadian histories of race and race relations, and then that plays out and emerges in these kind of anxieties and eruptions and attacks that you know, Nydia had to suffer through. Right? That for me are not just about anxiety, but they're also about ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Nydia, what are your thoughts on this?
I guess I will look at the angle of our own communities, how we, I guess we kind of don't sometimes appreciate how much healing needs to be done in our own circles, because we, you know, these systems of oppressions, we didn't create them and they don't benefit us, that's for sure. I mean, that's obvious. But we still have to live in these environments. And before, I guess, the system realizes how it does realize, but I mean, acknowledges how oppressive it is, we still have to find ways to heal ourselves and to be there for each other, and to find mechanisms that would ensure that we are more powerful in these situations, and that we're not just at the mercy of people's willingness to acknowledge their racist, I guess, attitudes and their privileges.
Can I just say to you, Nydia, that's such an important point, because okay, in a nation like Canada, where racism and the colonial histories of the nation are fundamentally denied, then what happens is it's very difficult today to start a conversation about race with Euro-Canadians in general. Not saying with all Euro-Canadians, but with many of them. They don't want to hear it because they do not believe that race is a factor in the lives of people of color and natives, because it's not a factor in their daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
So then what happens is that you get, as a person of color, as a Black person, as a Native person, constant denial about the impact of that racism in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Right? People do not want to hear that you are actually, you know, suffering psychologically, emotionally. I mean, racism actualizes in your body as a form of stress. Stress kills people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stress leads to heart disease. It leads to, like, depression. It leads to, there's all of these physical, biological manifestations that are occurring in people's lives because they're constantly dealing with the stress and violence of race in their daily lives. And that's something, too, that never gets acknowledged by the dominant Euro-Canadian mm-hmm. population, because they don't want to hear about it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just sitting here across looking at Mercedes, and I'm wondering if you, Mercedes is our co-host, Professor Nelson, if you weren't listening earlier. And Mercedes, I'm just wondering, as a student at McGill, a Black student at McGill, what you're thinking about this discussion and how so many of our classmates don't understand that slavery was here, and that even in informal discussions, we have to be like, oh, no, it was here, like mm-hmm. right here, like right on this campus, actually.
I think it rings true to a lot of what we're saying, especially what Professor Nelson had said about how it needs to go through the different levels of education, because it is true. In high school, you do learn. That your exposure to slavery in Canada starts with Underground Railroad and Harriet Tubman, and then you get little bits and pieces of Black History Month, and then it stops at Martin Luther King, and then after that's like, we've done it, guys. Yay, Canada. Right. This is what we are. We are the nation for the free, and it doesn't go beyond that. And then you get to places like McGill, where everyone's supposed to have been educated at the same level, everyone's supposed to have a certain level of intelligence, and then the things you hear from people, it's kind of like you don't know anything at all. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of express yourself as someone of color or who was exposed to this kind of history, like based on like what your parents had taught you, or let's say you did have that one teacher who decided, okay, this is what needs to be learned, like everything, not just the little fluffy pieces. They look at you and kind of, I don't know, not so much judge you, but kind of ask you like, no, it's not what it is at all. That's not what I learned. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, well, of course you wouldn't have learned that. You chose not to delve deeper into the issue and kind of remain at the surface. So then you come out as this, I guess it goes back to this whole angry Black person who can't reel in their emotions because everything comes down to something that's a touchy subject. So the best way to do it is not to deal with it and kind of gloss over it. And that way everybody in the scenario is comfortable. And I remember, I think it was actually Yasmin, who was also
our
collective member, had been in a conference, one of our poli-sci conference. I think the subject was slavery. And it was a student who was talking about it like she could relate to every Black person who, I don't know, who has kind of this historical context or whatever you want to call it. And then when Yasmin would speak out about it, it was kind of just like, okay, that's nice, dear. And then they continue talking as if she couldn't speak for herself. So, I mean, it's interesting to see the different phases that people go through. And then it's kind of also interesting to see just, I don't know, this whole notion that ignorance is bliss, because that's what just seems that's happening right now. And Alyssa, you had touched on like the two questions of what I was going to ask later on, but kind of just like the more we speak out about it, what is the necessary actions that we need to take to deal with this? And also, if the more we speak out about it, the more that is this society just going to continue to cover it up and pretend that it never existed?
Right. So, I mean, I really like the discussion, because I really feel that voices in unison on this are so much more powerful than Nydia feeling all alone, even though people are really behind her. And Professor Nelson, you being one of the few Black professors at McGill University with tenure, yay. So you're here for a long term. So it's just really nice to participate in this conversation. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there because of time. We only have 1 hour a month. But I thank you both so much for being with us. We're going to have to switch gears right away. Professor Nelson is a professor here at McGill, an associate professor of art history here at McGill, who studies the visual culture of slavery, race, and representation, as well as Black Canadian studies, a nascent field in this country. Nydia is a food justice advocate who blogs about Canadian and international social and political affairs. We thank you both once again.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
You guys. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. We switch gears for the rest of the show and bring you an excerpt from Jackie Wang's April keynote at the Waterloo Public Interest Group Conference, Engendering Resistance, Exploring the Possibilities of Gender Resistance and Militancy. Jackie's talk, Revolutionary Loneliness, is available in full online at Radio for All for those of you who are interested in hearing the full keynote. Today we hear from Jackie Wang, who was the keynote speaker at the conference Engendering Resistance, hosted by the School of Public Interest, an annual social and environmental justice gathering put on by the Waterloo Public Interest Research Group in Waterloo, Ontario. It was held April of this year. In the talk you are about to hear, Wang discusses how the experience of gendered and racialized forms of suffering can produce a sense of loneliness, an affective condition that emerges from feeling like one's existence is socially unintelligible. In addition to examining loneliness as an effect of relations in society at large, Wang looks at the forms of alienation that are produced in the process of struggle. Historically, revolutionary movements have based their politics on masculine and white positions, and thus failed to eradicate social alienation. Within these struggles, certain forms of suffering are dismissed because they are considered banal, everyday, insignificant, or derivative, and therefore are not considered proper points of departure for revolutionary struggles. This begs the question, which forms of suffering are considered political? which manifestations of self-sacrifice are considered heroic, and which are considered trivial. In the clip you are about to hear specifically, Wang reflects on the life and work of Sophia Bukhari of the Black Liberation Army. Jackie Wang is a writer currently based out of New Mexico. She writes about politics, literature, theory, and culture. She is part of the Moonroot Collective, an ongoing zine project that features the writing of Asian women and trans people, and has made short films about topics such as sexualized police brutality against women and bodily intimacy in the age of digital disembodiment. Her zines and chapbooks include On Being Hard Femme, Memoirs of a Queer Hapa, The Adventures of Lone Berry, and The Phallic Titty Manifesto. In her critical essay, she writes about queer sexuality, race, gender, the politics of writing, mixed race theory, identity, prisons and the police, the politics of safety and innocence, and revolutionary struggles. Through her poetry, she is trying to create a queer, anti-colonial, weird girl poetics of the body using hybridized writing styles. She is currently working on a book about revolutionary loneliness for the Semiotext Intervention series.
What role does loneliness play in the liberation narratives of militant women? And I expanded that to look at some trans warriors also. How does loneliness relate to the experience of gendered and racialized forms of violence? Which forms of suffering are considered political and which are considered banal, everyday, or insignificant? Why are certain forms of social suffering constructed as derivative, feminine, peripheral, personal, particular, and/or unimportant? Which forms of social suffering are considered proper points of departure for revolutionary struggles and which are not? And do revolutionary struggles generate new types of loneliness and alienation? So this is actually the last question ended up being like the major component of this project that I'm working on. But what I was thinking about when I was kind of like outlining my questions that I wanted to guide this project is why is it like a political act to like say fight the cops or something and not to fight your rapist? That's been recast for some people, but I think there we consider who do we consider, actually let me phrase this as a question, who do we consider political prisoners? It's not like the women who are in prison for attacking their rapists and abusers. There's actually a very, very tight definition of who we consider a political prisoner. And so there is a way in which certain types of suffering or oppression do not register as political. And so this is like, it makes this whole question of, you know, what is like a political act more complicated than we might think, because I think it's highly gendered, it's highly racialized, and there are these implicit assumptions that we don't necessarily examine. Okay, so I kind of started making a taxonomy in my head about types of social suffering or revolutionary loneliness. So there are different parts of the revolutionary experience that I'm interested in. Revolutionary trauma and PTSD. When we talk about like armed struggle and militant resistance, we don't necessarily think of like the trauma and the PTSD that often plagues people who participate in these movements. The pain of witnessing the murder, imprisonment, and exile of comrades, the psychological effects of incarceration, torture, and solitary confinement, the isolation that accompanies being betrayed by comrades, left melancholy and the despair that follows a failed revolution, the alienations that come with feeling like one's existence is unintelligible and one's labor and suffering is recognized by neither the larger society nor comrades. And this is something that, I don't know, maybe you've experienced where you get involved with something and you have this like hope, like this is going to be my new family, like these people are going to understand me and they're going to be, you know, they're going to want what I want, they're going to see what I do, they're going to recognize like the things that I've gone through. And then you get there and you're like, oh my gosh, I have to bracket this part of myself, like I feel like I have no outlet for this thing, like this meeting makes me crazy because like I don't operate on this wavelength, I don't communicate in this way. So all of those things are a part of political participation and can actually be produced in the process of struggling politically with people. So first, I wanted to talk about Safia Bukhari. She died in 2003. She was a member of the Black Liberation Army and the Black Panthers. She went underground for a while. She was captured. She was imprisoned. She spent time in solitary confinement. And she didn't write that much. There's a book that's like a collection of her essays. But a lot of them were like kind of like ideas for larger projects that she had in mind. And so she talks a lot about the trauma of seeing your comrades being assassinated or the trauma of going to prison. And she wanted to write a book about PTSD and the Black Panther Party. But all we get is she died before she could complete that project. But there's an essay called We Too Are Veterans, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorders in the Black Panther Party. And in that essay, she says, we had experienced the death and or imprisonment of countless of our brothers and sisters who had struggled right beside us, slept in the beds with us, eaten at the same table with us. As I write this, the picture of Tywan Myers, bullet-riddled body flashes before my eyes, shot so many times that his legs were almost shot off. Then the desecration of his funeral by the FBI's jumping from behind tombstones and out of trees at the cemetery with sawed-off guns and machine guns pointed at the mourners. Pictures pop in and out of our minds with no prompting. So here you can see that she's talking about the intense, intense state repression of the Black Panthers. There's a quote by Angela Davis that goes something like, we never had time to mourn. And she's referring to when the repression was most intense for the Black Panther Party. That's something when you hear people reflecting on their experiences in the Black Panther Party, it's a very common sentiment, like this idea that like things were so intense that nobody could even process like what was going on. And everyone, of course, was turning against each other, and there was this intense fear and paranoia in the atmosphere. So another thing that is really an important part of Safia Bukhari's narrative is the loneliness of leaving prison and returning to society to realize that the struggle has completely died. That is something that Safia experienced, but it didn't stop her from continuing her work. She did mainly political prisoner support, and that was her thing. And she was known for being like the person to go to for political prisoner support. Like, she was really reliable. She was so committed. Like, she had a lot of health problems, but she still traveled all around, like visiting political prisoners and corresponding with political prisoners and doing activist work to support political prisoners. And so that's something that's really depressing to think about, because like when these people went to prison, they had like this support network that kind of faded over time. She says, "I was determined that I would survive and one way or the other live to fight another day. We languished in the prisons and watched the growing lack of activity in the streets and promised ourselves that things would be different when we came home. Our intense belief in the rightness and justness of our cause and that things would be different when we returned to the streets, our awareness that we were still alive while our people's conditions have grown worse despite all of our sacrifices, all of this produces a traumatic shock to our system. This is the ultimate shock. We survived while others died. Despite all their intents and purposes, their deaths were in vain. The struggle hasn't been won. I contend that these elements have caused us to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder." I don't know. I mean, I don't really have anything hopeful to say about this, like, hypothetical notion of what's going to happen in the future. I do think that maybe one way we can think about breaking out of our contemporary deadlock is by centering political friendship and developing new ways to relate to each other with and through our wounds. So that's all I have to say. And if people have questions, you can ask questions. Thank you.
For Spitfire, this is Alyssa Clutterbuck, Women of Color Radio.
Turn me up. Ooh, I wanna hear the music.
Yeah.
I wanna feel that vibe.
Turn it up. Gotta make that money, man. Make your money, y'all. Just do what you got to do.
You are listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio only on CKUT 90.3 FM. And that brings us to the end of the show. We thank Nidia Dofe, Professor Nelson, and Jackie Wang, as well as the many others who made this show possible. And I would just like to say thank you to Tamara for helping us out today.
Yes, thank you so much.
And a shout out to Victoria, wherever you are. And Malek, get well soon. And everybody else who's out there, Yasmin and Preeti, wherever you are in the world, we miss you. Come back soon. Spitfire Women of Color Radio broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM. You can write to us at spitfire@ckut.ca and check out www.spitfire.blogspot.com.
Like them hoes sucking on your thing. Overworked and underpaid for days. Behave, I'm not gonna be your slave. People screaming hardcore, living in the ghetto, sleeping on the floor. What you thought I was gonna rise? Do my thing, get my piece of the pie. You're holding your breath for great God out the sky. Best live your life, cause you just waiting to die. People still taking life for a joke. Can't see the fire, but you blow out of smoke. If you didn't get it, you got what you deserve. Just like that, that's my word. Every day I wake up, scheming on the come up. No daydreaming, got to stay one up. How you gonna sit back and wait on the wealth? Gotta go get it, motivate yourself. If not, your
you're only perpetrating yourself, and at the end of the day, you only hate yourself. If you know me, you know my motto, take in charge. You got what it takes to make it. Make it all. Of course, the world got a problem, and it's yours. That's why I wrote this rhyme. You can quote this line, cause I focus mine. Living in some hopeless times, or so it seems. Never let go of your dreams, nah, man. Nah, man. Just do what you got to do.